Santa Monica, Wednesday, October 13th, 9:33 a.m. They were sitting on a bench across the street from the conference hall, just beyond the milling crowds near the entrance. It was a busy scene, but Hoffman ignored everything around him. He spoke rapidly, with great animation, moving his hand so wildly that he often slapped Evans in the chest, but he never seemed to notice. 10 years ago, I began with fashion and slang, he said. The latter being, of course, a kind of verbal fashion. I wanted to know the determinants of change in fashion and speech. What I quickly found is that there are no identifiable determinants. Fashions change for arbitrary reasons, and although there are regularities, cycles, periodicities, and correlations, these are merely descriptive, not explanatory. Are you following me?
I think so, Evans said.
In any case, I realized that these periodicities and correlations could be regarded as systems in themselves, or, if you will, ecosystems. I tested that hypothesis and found it heuristically valuable. Just as there is an ecology of the natural world, in the forests and mountains and oceans, so too there is an ecology of the man-made world of mental abstractions, ideas, and thought. That is what I have studied.
I see.
Within modern culture, ideas constantly rise and fall. For a while, everybody believes something, and then, bit by bit, they stop believing it. Eventually, no one can remember the old idea, the way no one can remember the old slang. Ideas are themselves a kind of fad, you see.
I understand, Professor, but why...
Why do ideas fall out of favor, you are wondering? Hoffman said. He was talking to himself. The answer is simply, they do. In fashion, as in natural ecology, there are disruptions, sharp revisions of the established order. A lightning fire burns down a forest. A different species springs up in the charred acreage. Accidental, haphazard, unexpected, abrupt change. That is what the world shows us on every side.
Professor,
but just as ideas can change abruptly, so too can they hang on past their time. Some ideas continue to be embraced by the public long after scientists have abandoned them. Left brain, right brain is a perfect example. In the 1970s, it gains popularity from the work of Sperry at Caltech, who studies a specific group of brain surgery patients. His findings have no broader meaning beyond these patients. Sperry denies any broader meaning. By 1980, it is clear that the left and right brain notion is just wrong. The two sides of the brain don't work separately in a healthy person. But in the popular culture, the concept does not die for another 20 years. People talk about it, believe it, write books about it for decades after scientists have set it aside.
Yes, all very interesting.
Similarly, in environmental thought, it was widely accepted in 1960 that there is something called the balance of nature. If you just left nature alone, it would come into a self-maintaining state of balance. Lovely idea, with a long pedigree. The Greeks believed it 3,000 years ago on the basis of nothing. Just seemed nice. However, by 1990, no scientist believes in the balance of nature anymore. The ecologists have all given it up as simply wrong, untrue, fantasy. They speak now of dynamic disequilibrium, of multiple equilibrium states. But they now understand that nature is never in balance, never has been, never will be. On the contrary, nature is always out of balance, and that means...
Professor, Evans said,
I'd like to ask you, that means that mankind, which was formerly defined as a great evil, the great disruptor of the natural order, is nothing of the sort. The whole environment is being constantly disrupted all the time anyway.
But George Morton...
Yes, yes, you wonder what I discussed with George Morton. I am coming to that. We are not off topic.
Because, of course, Morton wanted to know about environmental ideas, and particularly the idea of environmental crisis. What did you tell him? If you study the media, as my graduate students and I do, seeking to find shifts in normative conceptualization, you discover something extremely interesting. We looked at transcripts of news programs of the major networks, NBC, ABC, CBS. We also looked at stories in the newspapers of New York, Washington, Miami, Los Angeles, and Seattle. We counted the frequency of certain concepts and terms used by the media. The results were very striking. He paused. "What did you find?" Evans said, taking his cue. "There was a major shift in the fall of 1989. Before that time, the media did not make excessive use of terms such as crisis, catastrophe, cataclysm, plague, or disaster. For example, during the 1980s, the word crisis appeared in news reports about as often as the word budget. In addition, prior to 1989, adjectives such as dire, unprecedented, dreaded were not common in television reports or newspaper headlines. But then it all changed."
"In what way?"
"These terms started to become more and more common. The word catastrophe was used five times more often in 1995 than it was in 1985. Its use doubled again by the year 2000. And the stories changed, too. There was a heightened emphasis on fear, worry, danger, uncertainty, panic."
"Why should it have changed in 1989?
"Ah, a good question. Critical question. In most respects, 1989 seemed like a normal year. A Soviet sub sank in Norway. Tiananmen Square in China. The Exxon Valdez. Salman Rushdie sentenced to death. Jane Fonda, Mike Tyson, and Bruce Springsteen all got divorced. The Episcopal Church hired a female bishop. Poland allowed striking unions. Voyager went to Neptune. A San Francisco earthquake flattened highways. And Russia, the U.S., France, and England all conducted nuclear tests. A year like any other. But in fact, the rise in the use of the term crisis can be located with some precision in the autumn of 1989. And it seemed suspicious that it should coincide so closely with the fall of the Berlin Wall, which happened on November 9th of that year." Hoffman fell silent again, looking at Evans in a significant way, very pleased with himself. Evans said, "I'm sorry, Professor, I don't get it."
"Neither did we. At first, we thought the association was spurious, but it wasn't. The Berlin Wall marks the collapse of the Soviet Empire, and the end of the Cold War that had lasted for half a century in the West."
Another silence. Another pleased look. "I'm sorry," Evans said finally. "I was 13 years old then, and..." He shrugged. "I don't see where you were leading."
"I am leading to the notion of social control, Peter. To the requirement of every sovereign state to exert control over the behavior of its citizens, to keep them orderly and reasonably docile, to keep them driving on the right side of the road, or the left, as the case may be, to keep them paying taxes. And, of course, we know that social control is best managed through fear."
"Fear," Evans said.
"Exactly. For 50 years, Western nations had maintained their citizens in a state of perpetual fear. Fear of the other side. Fear of nuclear war. The communist menace. The Iron Curtain. The evil empire. And within the communist countries, the same, in reverse. Fear of us. Then, suddenly, in the fall of 1989, it was all finished. Gone. Vanished. Over. The fall of the Berlin Wall created a vacuum of fear. Nature abhors a vacuum. Something had to fill it."
Evans frowned. You're saying that environmental crises took the place of the Cold War?
That is what the evidence shows. Of course, now we have radical fundamentalism and post-9/11 terrorism to make us afraid, and those are certainly real reasons for fear. But that is not my point. My point is, there is always a cause for fear. The cause may change over time, but the fear is always with us. Before terrorism, we feared the toxic environment. Before that, we had the communist menace. The point is, although the specific cause of our fear may change, we are never without the fear itself. Fear pervades society in all aspects, perpetually.
He shifted on the concrete bench, turning away from the crowds.